From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Over the past couple of weeks, both President Trump and Congress have proposed multiple changes to the Endangered Species Act. Those changes are controversial, but it's worth noting that this isn't the first attempt to modify the act. In fact, the Center for Biological Diversity says there have been more than 300 changes or proposed changes in the past two decades, and the pace has picked up in the past several years. It's worth noting, though, that the majority of Americans across the political spectrum support the Endangered Species Act, and the act has a strong track record of preventing extinctions. Actually bringing populations back to healthy levels, though, that has proved more difficult. And there's a growing recognition among conservation biologists that we won't be able to save everything. So how do we pick which species we put the most effort into conserving? One popular idea has been to try to maximize the diversity of species, but a new analysis says that might not have the desired effect. Will Pierce is an assistant professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at Utah State University and senior author on that new study. Will, welcome to the show.
Hey, nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
A lot of scientists have said we are in the midst of an extinction crisis. I think some communications from your university compared it to trying to figure out who to put onto Noah's Ark, but with limited space and a sinking ship. How bad is the situation?
It is pretty bad, but I think it's important to recognize that nothing is a foregone conclusion. So at the moment, we are in the midst of a mass extinction. Extinction rates are massively above what we've been seeing historically, and it is concerning. It is definitely concerning. But there's still time to turn things around. It's relatively straightforward, I think, to make sure that we preserve the biodiversity that we need if we make a few simple changes.
What do you mean by the biodiversity that we need?
A lot of people think that the only people who like the natural world and biodiversity and things like that are sort of eco-warriors or things like that. But the reality is that we all rely upon things like bees for pollination and crops for food. Ecosystems provide a number of functions and services that help us do the things that we love and, eat, play, enjoy and such. And it's reasonably straightforward to preserve that by preserving biodiversity.
So what is driving the extinction crisis? What specifically?
There are a number of factors, but I think the major one at the moment is habitat loss. It's a pretty simple equation. Things live in a place, and so if you cut down or damage or degrade that place where things live, not all of them are going to survive.
And what about climate change? Where does that factor in?
Climate change is absolutely a major factor, and it's becoming increasingly a major factor. Species have certain environmental tolerances, and as climate changes, that pushes those species outside of that sort of envelope of their tolerances. What a species can do then is it might need to migrate or move in order to try and track those conditions. And as we lose habitat, it can be harder for species to track that. And it also becomes a factor when we're designing protected areas and reserves, because we want to make sure that those areas will be affected in the future. And that's obviously more difficult to do because we need to design them so that they will work today and in the future.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about the Endangered Species Act. That was, designed and created basically to address issues like hunting or habitat loss, much more localized, direct impacts on species instead of something like climate change. Is it still an effective tool when we're talking about conserving species for these coming changes that might require movement and very different kinds of adaptation?
So before talking about that, I want to make it very clear, as you can probably tell from my accent, I'm not American, and so I'm certainly not an expert on the Endangered Species Act. And so it's very difficult for me to make very specific comments on it. But I would say that the people working to prioritize and pick species do a very good job of checking and confirming and examining the biological requirements of species. And so really, climate change is something we can predict, we can understand, and we can design reserves around it. So I think the biologists involved in implementing things to sort of preserve species are definitely able to do that with the tools they have at hand.
Well, you mentioned this idea of prioritizing species, whether it's the Endangered Species Act, which is a U.S. federal law or something that's more international, like the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species, how does something get listed? What makes it onto that list, and how do they prioritize that list, or do they prioritize that list?
So the IUCN Red List is very clearly not a list of sort of prioritization. It's an attempt to try and figure out species that look like they're in threat of becoming extinct. But very much their aim is to just highlight species that look like they're at threat. They're not sort of necessarily saying that we have to do anything with that information. They're kind of putting it out there and saying, you know, policymakers and biologists and the public, what do you want to do now you have this information in hand? But for the Red List, they have a series of essentially five major kinds of criteria that a species can be listed under. And they all relate essentially in some way to things that species tend to do when their population is collapsing or massively declining, and it looks as if that decline might not reverse, and if it might be an unnatural decline, something that might be a portent of a species going extinct in the foreseeable future.
And how many species are there currently on that list?
Well, it's changing all the time, and they're updating it all the time. So I don't know the exact numbers off the top of my head. And one of the wonderful things about the work that the IUCN does is that any number I say now is almost certainly going to be out of date, because they're adding species to it almost on a daily basis, both recording ones that look as if they are they are least concerned and ones that do appear to be threatened. But it's a really cool website, and I would actually encourage all of your listeners to go onto the IUCN Red List. It's a great site. You get pictures of the organisms. It's really fun to look at. And it's also actually on Wikipedia pages for animals as well. If you go there, you'll see it in the top right-hand corner. It's one of those things that once you know it's there, it's everywhere.
I mean, it's great that they're constantly updating it, but it's not necessarily great news that the number is always getting higher. Is that part of what is behind the idea that we can't possibly save everything?
Well, so that they're always examining more species. That doesn't necessarily mean that the number of species that are threatened is always going up. But you are correct. The numbers of species that are currently endangered, it is concerning. And that is one of the reasons why it does appear at the moment we don't seem to have enough money to do everything that we would like. And so that is where some degree of triage, prioritization, is increasingly coming into play. Biologists are making sort of heartbreaking decisions, really, where they're saying, you know, in order to preserve the ecosystem and the functions that performs for us at the level we'd like to save everything, but we've only got this much money. So what's the next best thing that we could do?
So one idea for how to prioritize has been to pick species, and maybe just for shorthand right now, we'll talk about animals. Pick animals that are as broadly diverse in an evolutionary sense as they can possibly be, and that should give us, you know, a nice diverse representation of what animals do in ecosystems, and maybe that would be a good way to prioritize. But you've looked at that now and found that maybe it wouldn't be as effective as people thought.
Well, I think it's important to be very clear, actually. So what you're talking about there, you're right, evolutionary diversity. So we like to call it sort of rather fancifully branches on the tree of life. So you can sort of, in much the same way that we all have a family tree, you can make a family tree of species. And the idea is that you want to preserve as many branches on that family tree of species. We call that a phylogeny. You want to preserve as many branches on that phylogeny as you can, because it tends to be the case that closely related species tend to share traits in common. And so if you want to maximize the diversity of traits, the diversity of functions that species have, you'd want to keep as many branches on the tree of life as possible. And so you'd want to preserve a diverse set of species.
So maybe prioritize saving branches, but don't worry so much about keeping every leaf on every branch.
Well, ideally, we would like to save every leaf on every branch and every leech, as I just said. but if we can't do that, then yes, that would be the sort of the idea. And to be very clear, the broad take home from our paper is that doing that does work. We call it the phylogenetic gambit. The idea that if you save lots of branches on that phylogeny, you will save lots of function. And that is broadly what we find. The caveat to that is that there are certain parts of the world and certain kinds of animals for which that doesn't seem to work so well. And so the really useful thing, I think, actually, in our study is both that we verify that use of phylogenetic diversity is a good thing, but we also highlight times when it might not be such a good thing to use. And that's really useful for conservation biologists because, you know, it's one thing to know when something that something works, but it's another to know in nuance and detail exactly how it's working and where it works best. And so we were really happy with the results of the study.
So in those places or in those cases where, you know, evolutionary diversity is not the best indicator of whether or not a species should be high priority, what are the other ways of determining that?
Well, so one of the key ones, I would say, and it's one that's sort of in some ways obvious, and I think it's good that people do use this, is, first of all, what you can save easily. So, you know, clearly, if you have a limited budget, we want to make sure that we sort of save as many things as we can. And so one option that's often used quite sensibly is to save things that look like they would be easy to save, because that means you can save more of them.
Low-hanging fruit, to keep up with our tree analogy here.
Yes, exactly. Yes, yeah, yeah. You know, have as many apples as you can or whatever. One of the other ways is by essentially conducting very detailed studies to figure out exactly what's going on in a system. So one of the advantages of phylogenetic diversity is that it's reasonably straightforward to figure out where a species is in the tree of life. Now, I say reasonably straightforward because that is actually sort of one of the things that I spend a lot of my time doing. So I wouldn't say it's easy, but, you know, it's in many ways much more straightforward than spending hours and hours and hours in the field studying and observing and tracking exactly what a species does. But ultimately, if you do want to prioritize on the basis of what species do and you're worried that phylogeny might not do it, you've got to do the hard field work. You've got to do those long hours in the field, figuring out what it eats, what eats it, what kinds of environmental tolerances it has, and then using that to figure out what its impact is on the ecosystem as a whole.
What about just trying to conserve ecosystems as a whole? Instead of thinking about one species here and one species there, what about just setting aside an area and saying, this is an ecosystem, so we're just going to preserve that ecosystem there and keep all of the species in it?
That's a great point. And that is on the ground how a lot of conservation works. And I should add, actually, that in our analysis, we sort of included a spatial component. So we looked to see how applying these kinds of phylogenetic prioritizations work across space. And it was for exactly that reason that, yes, a lot of conservation plays out on the ground. And for in cases like that, where you're sort of dealing with ecosystems, we're still coming up with sort of, you know, the best practices for how to pick those areas, but definitely the diversity within them. And of course, how much of an ecosystem is left is important. And I think it's really exciting in that regard that if you go onto the IUCN Red List site for species, if you poke around a little, you'll see that they're beginning to develop red lists for ecosystems. And those are extremely exciting. And I think that's a really, really useful tool to have because it gives people a kind of a big picture view of what habitat types are threatened across the planet. I really like the Red List of Ecosystems. I think it's great.
Will Pierce is an assistant professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at Utah State University. Will, thanks for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. Have a great day.
Up next, should researchers return personal data to study participants? Find out what the National Academies has to say on that topic when Living Lab Radio continues.